Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Welcome to the show, everyone, and I do have a show for you today. A quick warning that it is a rerun, but it's a nice old one, so there's a good chance you haven't heard it, and it's full of all kinds of evergreen content, so it's definitely worth your time. But before we begin, I have an announcement to make. It is not a happy announcement of any kind. Unfortunately, I have to come to you and explain a very sad situation, a very unfortunate situation, which is that I have discovered labor rights abuses happening literally right under my nose, having to do with the work that goes into this show. Obviously, I'm not happy or proud to be talking about that, shocking as it is for a progressive show that consistently preaches labor rights and going far beyond that, and the importance of making sure people can get outside the world of work and experience all the rest that life has to offer. And yet right here, there have been some problems happening, honestly. And obviously I have to accept complicity in what was going on. But as I say, it was sort of happening under my nose and without my full awareness. So, what's happened, I'm happy to explain. For you to really understand, you have to understand sort of the structure of how this show works. A lot of people write in and they say things like, Jay and your team, or, everyone at Best of Left, or, your whole staff there or whatever. And so I totally get that there's a lack of awareness about how this show comes together. And so the structure is basically like this. There's me. I do sort of the research, production, hosting gig. Under me, there's always been, well, not always, but for the last few years, there's been someone who does research on activism, maybe dabbles in social media work, that sort of thing. There have been a couple of previous people who held that position. When the last person let me know that they were going to leave, I replaced them with a person who happened to have every single one of the skill sets that I needed for all the writing, research, communications, social media, all of that stuff, who just happened to be my girlfriend. That's Amanda Hoffman, who you hear thanked in the in the credits at the end of every episode. And aside from us, there is just one other volunteer who has been a steadfast contributor, who I hope is only putting in an hour, maybe a couple of hours a week, helping gather, sort, organize clips. And those all flow to me, and I use that as part of my research. So where are all these labor rights abuses happening, and who's that affecting? Honestly, it turns out it's just me. It's not much more complicated than the fact that I've been working too much, and I didn't realize it. That is the honest truth. And I started getting this inkling, like, I think something might be going on. This feels harder than it used to be. And there was no moment when, there was a straw that broke the camel's back, that, the camel's back didn't break. But there was a point when I took a look at the camel and I was like, oh man, that looks like a really unhealthy camel with a really heavy load on his back. Maybe I should do something about that. So what I did recently was set up some of those time tracking apps on my computer and my phone to actually get some data on how much work I put into the show. And for a long time, I had been predicting that that number would be in the 40 to 50 hour range. And it turns out it's more like 60. And I thought, oh no, no wonder I'm tired all the time and don't have time to do a lot of the things I want to do, like read or have conversations with humans or any number of things. So after some thought and some consideration and some more thought and some organizing, what I have decided to do is cut down on the production schedule of the show, just a bit. Unfortunately, I've done this in the past, and if you can believe it, I used to do 10 episodes a month, and then I realized that was too much, so I cut down to 8. And honestly, that felt pretty okay for a really long time. And what has happened is, you know, honestly, there is so much more to listen to now. There is so much more research that goes into the show now than there used to be, that I think that's the largest contributing factor. So I think that the show is better now than it's ever been. It includes more voices from more people, gets more perspectives, is more nuanced than ever before. But it turns out that means it takes more time. In addition, just on the business end, like, I do ads now that I didn't have access to before, which in turn pay for the activism that we do and a bunch of other stuff, you know, production considerations and social media output and all of those things that I didn't have the money to do before. I can now pay a living wage to a person who can do all of that stuff. So we have, you know, consistent high quality activism and a bunch of other things that go on behind the scenes and go out on other, you know, platforms, social media and all that. And so things are going well. People are getting paid a living wage. And in the process of all of that, the one thing I missed was how much my hours were increasing tick by tick by tick. Each little additional project, each little additional, you know, bit of work I had to do just sort of crept up and crept and crept and crept. And now all of a sudden, I didn't fully realize it until I presented myself with the data and am confronted with the irrevocable answer that something massive has to be done. Steps need to be taken. I need to pull back in one way or another. That could mean like hiring someone to be an associate producer who takes some of the workload off, but I don't have the money for that now. Maybe that's where we can go in the future. But as it stands, it's more important that right now I just get myself on a sustainable work schedule so I get back to feeling good and healthy and productive and all of those things and put out a really high quality show on a regular basis. But instead of doing 8 episodes a month, 2 of those episodes are going to now be replaced with reruns. But in exchange, I'm going to do something that I've really wanted to do. This is one of those canaries in the coal mine, is that members are supposed to be getting bonus content, and where we, you know, I just do sort of a, you know, casual discussion about this or that topic. And I have not had time to do that recently. So I've been feeling really bad. Basically the members who are supporting the show are sort of getting screwed a little bit. They weren't getting, you know, I mean, mostly they're paying because they want to support the show for what it is. And the bonus content is just that, you know, it's bonus. It's a little bit extra. It's nice, but it's not critical for most people. But it's something that I have been saying for a long time that I want to do. And then I haven't been pulling through on that. And I've been frustrated and thinking like, what's happening? Why can't I find the time? And then I learned that I've been working 60 hours and thought, oh, okay, that's why. That's why I can't find the time. So instead of doing 8 full size, you know, heavy lift episodes per month, I'm going to do 6 of the full size heavy lift episodes per month, plus promising 2 members shows that, you know, I hope are good and informative and thoughtful and sort of give more insight into my perspective and, you know, where I'm coming from, and just sort of in a natural way help you get to know me to, you know, to some degree, because like I'm not the star of this show. I'm the host, I'm the producer, but I let other people do most of the talking. And so many of you, I'm sure, think like, hey, you know, who is this guy exactly who's producing this show? And like, I kind of like the clips he's pulling, but you know, what does he think? Where is he coming from? What biases does he have? Whatever. And so hopefully that's where the bonus content comes in, and the members get just that, you know, little bit of extra insight into who's working on this show. So that's what's going to happen. Still doing 8 episodes a month. It's just the 2 of them are bonus episodes for members. Everyone else gets standard reruns during those weeks, which, as it should be noted, is totally common practice in the podcasting world. You know, look at any major podcast that even just has a weekly show and take note of how many times they put out rerun episodes. So it's part of the natural landscape. It's something that I just need to embrace and understand that this is what it takes to make a high quality, sustainable show in which the people working on it don't have to work themselves to death. And as I say, I'm totally open to the idea of somewhere down the road, if we get enough support, enough members join up, you know, and just enough money coming in that we can afford to hire another associate producer to help that whole show production process, then either the shows are just going to get that much better, or we can get back up to a normal production schedule of twice a week, or, you know, whatever it ends up being. So no promises on a timeline for that. I'm not launching an official fundraising campaign with a goal to get us to that point, at the moment, but I'm just letting you know that those are things I'm open to. Those are things I'm thinking about. My goal with the show is not just to have a show because it's fun to have a show. It's not to make money because it's a job. It goes a lot deeper than that. Like, I really care about the topics I'm covering. I really care about the activism that we put out. And so my preference is to put out as many of these episodes as possible because I think they're valuable. I hope they're valuable. So in the long run, hopefully I can get to a point where I can put out more, because I would think that it's a good thing to put out more. That's just not where we're at right now. We need to recognize the realities on the ground and adjust accordingly. So thank you in advance for your understanding and your support. If you would like to support the show directly by becoming a member, now, as I explained, is sort of a good time to do it. I haven't been doing bonus content for a little while, but they're coming out now with the promise of that being on a more regular basis than before. So the first episode that's out is coming out today, the same time as this rerun episode, just for members, and that goes into more detail. Actually, Amanda and I sit down together and discuss how we got to where we are, how we got to this point, and our thoughts about what we're going to do about it. So members, be sure to check your member-only feeds to hear that, and anyone who is interested in hearing it and all the future bonus content, you can sign up to be a member at the Contribute tab at bestoftheleft.com. And now, with all of that out of the way, please enjoy today's rerun episode, fittingly, I think, focused on the importance of the labor movement. This program is made possible by the members and donors to the show. For details, visit the membership tab at bestoftheleft.com. Now, welcome to the award-winning Best of the Left podcast with clips today from The David Pakman Show, The Young Turks, Real Time with Bill Maher, Jim Hightower, The Tom Hartman Program, Grit TV with Laura Flanders, Activism from the Unfuck It Up Project, and The Majority Report. Now, enjoy the show, everyone, and don't forget to tip your servers.
I want to talk briefly about the American dream. I saw the documentary Park Avenue the other day. If you have Netflix, it's on Netflix. You can find it hopefully some other places as well. And the documentary looks at Park Avenue in Manhattan, and then at Park Avenue, as you go north in Manhattan, over the water in the Bronx, Park Avenue in the Bronx, and just the drastic difference between the Manhattan Park Avenue, where some of the richest hedge fund guys and Koch brothers and others have apartments, and Park Avenue in the Bronx, in an area where there is overwhelming poverty, overwhelming unemployment, 40 and 20% respectively at certain periods in the last few years. And I really started thinking about whether the American dream is even a reasonable thing to be teaching children as they grow up to believe in. And what I mean by that is, I don't mean teaching children that they should try to be whatever they want to be when they grow up, that there are opportunities for them to learn, to travel, to work, to explore, and to become kind of self-realized, well-rounded human beings. That is a good thing to teach children. But what I'm talking about is the idea that, truly speaking, everybody has an equal shot at being successful, whatever success means to that particular person. Because factually speaking, upward mobility is very, very low in this country, particularly compared to other countries at the same level of development where the U.S. is. People who are born into significant poverty rarely get out of it. Now, this is the point where a lot of people will be watching this and they'll say, hold on a second. All these actors, all these rappers, all these athletes. Think about all of these people who started poor and they are now doing very well for themselves. We need to think about large numbers. The fact that you can come up with several hundred or even several thousand individuals who have inspirational stories about lifting themselves out of poverty to incredible riches does not change the fact that when you look at the numbers, very, very few people who are born extremely poor are ever anything other than maybe slightly less poor. That's just the reality, Lewis.
Yeah, the numbers speak for themselves. What's a few thousand compared to 300 plus million? It's the numbers. That's where the facts are.
The best example I've always had, because people, I can see the YouTube comments and people will say, David, we don't have racism in this country anymore. President Obama is the president and we have affirmative action and everybody has the same shot and discrimination's not legal. We have a fair society. Everyone plays by the same rules. And an example I've been using for years, and I encourage you to use it when you talk to people about these issues, is actually used in the documentary Park Avenue, which is, think about the game Monopoly. Everyone starts with the same amount of money. Everyone starts with presumably the same mobility in terms of your rolling two dice. However, think about what would happen if you join the game after your four friends have been playing for an hour. You get the same amount of money they got at the beginning. You roll the dice, but the property's been bought up. There's a system where rents have been driven up because the number of houses and hotels that friends have on their properties, just because now the rules have been equalized where you were first not allowed to play and now you are, it's too late in the game. And the idea that because now on paper the rules are the same, it doesn't mean we don't have significant structural issues that prevent upward mobility and essentially make the American dream truly a very distant dream for most people born into poverty.
McDonald's employee by the name of Nancy Salgado went to a press conference where the USA president of McDonald's, Jeff Stratton, was speaking, and here's what happened.
Woman and a single mother of two, it's really hard for me to feed my two kids and struggle day to day. Do you think this is fair that I have to be making $8.25 when I've worked for McDonald's for 10 years? The thing is that I need a raise, but you're not helping your employees. How is this possible?
You're going to be arrested.
You are doing, you're asking and you're out here putting your face and said, I've done all this, but to your employees, you haven't done anything.
All right, and visit therealnews.com for more video of that situation. They did a good job covering that. But I love the fact that she literally spoke truth to power there, mm-hmm. because he didn't expect that. He didn't see it coming. And I love how the security guard says, you're going to get arrested. For what? For speaking the truth? For talking about how she can't feed her own family? And as you guys know, fast food workers have been protesting. They've been striking because they want to get paid $15 an hour. They want to have the right to form unions. And it seems like these businesses are refusing to allow them to do that.
And when else would she have access to McDonald's USA president? So it's not like, hey, you did it in the wrong way. Normally, he's meeting with your employees all the time, mm-hmm. you know. But so why did you have to cause a ruckus? No, and she didn't cause a ruckus. She simply stated what her issue was. Now, look, if there was a continuing disturbance, yada, yada, I understand. But it certainly didn't seem to rise to that level where they threatened their arrest at that point. And by the way, more importantly, the CEO could have answered the question, right?
Yeah, I've been here for 40 years.
And
that doesn't answer anything.
And by the way, did you start at, when you were 10 years in, were you making $8.25? I would be surprised if you could have said that, if that was the case, because we did the story where the managers come from the employee ranks only like 3% of the time in fast food,
right?
Joints like this. And so very unlikely that the CEO used to actually, you know, make burgers back in the day. So that's not something that happens often. But if it was, you can tell us your story. Or if you're the CEO and look, somebody asked me about their salary, you answer them and you say, hey, listen, here's why we pay what we pay. I understand your situation and I think it's really tough. And I love you for working at McDonald's, you know, under those tough circumstances, I know. And you've been with us for 10 years and I appreciate your loyalty. You know, we try to do the best we can, but here's our cost structure, et cetera. But he apparently doesn't have that answer. So he goes, well, oh, yeah, I've been here 40 years. Somebody arrest her. Get her out of here.
Yeah, and he doesn't have that answer because there's absolutely no reason why these, you know, low-level employees shouldn't get paid more money. Okay, they get paid minimum wage. That's just how it goes. And she's been with the company for years. It's not like she's been there for like a few months and she's asking for $15 an hour. Just to let you guys know exactly how much they make in profits, last year alone, McDonald's made $5.5 billion in profits.
See, that's why the answer is impossible for him.
Yeah.
Because he can't in good conscience say, well, I could pay you a living wage, but then we'd only make $4.5 billion in profits, right? And the reality is he could, and they would make 4.5, and then he would get fired, right?
Yeah.
Because they would say, you could have made 5.5. So we will now have someone else run the robot that is this corporation that happens to be, in this case, McDonald's, and we will squeeze every red cent out of our customers and mainly our employees to make sure we make the maximum amount of profit. Mm-hmm. So look, corporations are built this way. You can't build a machine and then damn the machine, right? Understand how it works. If you want to fix it, then fix the code, right? Say, hey, you know what? Corporations will no longer work this way. They'll work slightly different, right? We need a profit motive, but we could do it in a slightly different way. For example, in Germany, labor is half of the board. So then they actually care about their employees. It's not like Germany's doing poorly. Second best economy in the world, right? So there's a different way to structure the machine so you get the result you want instead of the result we've gotten where the majority of us get crushed and the guys at the very top of the machine get all the money.
Until Ronald McDonald starts paying his employees a living wage, he has to wipe that fucking smile off his face.
Yeah, there we go.
I've won you back.
Yeah. I'm with you on that one.
A new study says the median income for fast food jobs is $8.69 an hour. And let's face it, that is barely enough to gas up the car you're living in. Remember this Subway sandwich maker who a couple of months ago tweeted a picture of himself wiping his dick on the bun? You can hate him, but you can't really blame him. Now, when it comes to raising the minimum wage, conservatives always say it's a non-starter because it cuts into profits. Well, yeah, of course. Paying workers is one of those unfortunate expenses of running a business. You know, like taxes or making a product. If you want to get rich with a tax-free enterprise that sells nothing, start a church. You might think that paying people enough to live is so self-evident that even crazy people could understand it, but you would be wrong. Michelle Bachmann is not only against raising the minimum wage, she's against having one at all. She once said if we took away the minimum wage, we could virtually wipe out unemployment because we would be able to offer jobs at whatever level. Put that in your brain and smoke it. You could hire everyone if you didn't have to pay them. And naturally, Ted Cruz agrees. Ted Cruz thinks it's a good thing that when his Cuban father came to America, he was paid 50 cents an hour to work as a dishwasher before becoming Charo. When did the American dream become this pathway to indentured servitude? This economic death spiral where workers get paid next to nothing, so they can only afford to buy next to nothing, so businesses are forced to sell cheaper and cheaper shit. Walmart employees can only afford to shop at Walmart. McDonald's workers can only afford to eat at McDonald's. And Hooters waitresses have to wear shirts they grew out of years ago. And look, even if you're not moved by the don't be such a heartless prick argument, consider the fact that most fast food workers, whose average age, by the way, now is 29, I'm not talking about kids, are on some form of public assistance, which is not surprising when even working people can't make enough to live. They take money from the government in the form of food stamps, school lunches, housing assistance, daycare. This is the welfare that conservatives hate. But they never stop to think, if we raised the minimum wage and forced McDonald's and Walmart to pay their employees enough to eat, we, the taxpayers, wouldn't have to pick up the slack. This is the question the right has to answer. Do you want smaller government with less handouts, or do you want a low minimum wage? Because you cannot have both. If Colonel Sanders isn't going to pay the lady behind the counter enough to live on, then Uncle Sam has to. And I, for one, am getting a little tired of helping highly profitable companies pay their workers. Especially when I don't even eat at KFC. Yeah. I mean, I get high, not that high.
One question I get a lot from listeners has to do with how long it takes me to make an episode of Best of the Left. Well, between all the research, show prep, and actual editing, it comes out to around 20 hours of work for each one of the 10 episodes I make every month. Obviously, this is only possible because of the listeners who chip in a few bucks each month to make it happen, so if you appreciate this show and think it provides a valuable service, then please think about becoming a member at the $10 a month level. That's only a buck a show, after all. I've always believed in giving away the show for free so everyone can hear it without restrictions, so if you can afford 10 bucks a month, that covers yourself and several others who maybe can't afford to pay but who need to hear the show as much as anyone. As thanks, members also receive bonus content including extra voicemails, behind-the-scenes stories, and more of my personal musings. Thanks so much for your support.
Let us all now bow before the God of free enterprise, whose awesomeness was revealed in a recent news release announcing that the divine managers of fast food demigod McDonald's achieved a profit of $1.5 billion in just 3 months this summer. Holy Big Mac! How did it do that? Peek behind the curtain and you'll see that McDonald's secret power is thee and me, America's taxpayers. The corporation rips off its huge workforce by paying poverty wages and no benefits, then directs the workers to the food stamp office and other government-funded safety net programs. Neat, huh? A major chunk of the chain's cost of doing business disappears from the corporate books and shazam, reappears on the government's books. In fact, the National Employment Law Project reports that McDonald's phenomenal $1.5 billion profit is bloated by an estimated $1.2 billion that we taxpayers will shell out this year to support its predatory wage and benefit policy. Aren't you loving it, as the chain's ads say? But the Golden Arches are not alone in this fast food flim-flam. The conglomerate owner of Kentucky Fried Chicken, Pizza Hut, and Taco Bell duns us for $648 million to underwrite its poverty pay. Subway burrows into us for $436 million. Burger King, a British outfit, taps us for $356 million. Little Sweet Wendy's grabs more than $250 million from us, and Dunkin' Donuts dips into our pockets for $274 million. And look here, it's Domino's Pizza, whose extremist right-wing owner says he hates government spending. But he's picking the taxpayers' pockets to the tune of $126 million to subsidize his free enterprise. This is Jim Hightower saying, the corporate powers preach about the magic of the marketplace, but magicians don't do magic, they perform illusions.
Do you believe in magic in a young girl's heart? There's this restaurant. There's actually a couple of them. This is happening. Here we go. Jay Porter, the founder of Linkery, previously of San Diego, currently close to move to San Francisco, eliminated tipping in that restaurant's second year. Instead, he put an 18% surcharge and just, you know, everybody gets the tip. So that's one way to do it. Another is other restaurants are simply saying, you know, instead of paying our wait staff $3 an hour plus tips, we're going to pay them, you know, $15 an hour plus benefits, period. And just say no tipping. Another option, which I don't see anybody discussing in the United States, but it's kind of a middle ground, is to say, you can tip, but you can't tip over 10%. So it's kind of the European model. In fact, Europeans are the bane of the existence. First time European tourists to the United States are the bane of the lives of people who work at restaurants on the East Coast. Well, all over the country, presumably, but I know in particular on the East Coast and the West Coast, where tourists just suddenly pop up from Germany or France and they tip 5% and think that they're really, really doing good, right? 10%? Wow! I mean, when you're in Europe, in many of these countries and many of these places, you kind of basically tip with pocket change. Because the person is already making a decent wage. In fact, if you don't get really superlative service, don't tip at all. Nobody's offended. Well, maybe a little bit. But the point is that tipping is that for wait staffs, this is kind of the last of the meritocracies in the United States. Or the last place, one of the few places where consumers have a direct interface and are able to, with people who are providing services and are able to respond to that in a way that is calibrated to the quality of service they got. Going to a McDonald's, you don't tip the person at McDonald's. If you go into a department store or go into Walmart, buy something, somebody helps you out, you don't tip them. But taxis, and even that, I mean, you know, Uber now doesn't take tips. You can't tip an Uber driver. Instead, what happens, Uber is the service that is giving the taxis a run for their money big time here in Washington, D.C., where limousine drivers in their spare time will pick you up. It's a whole computer, you know, runs on an iPhone kind of thing. And it's all computerized. It's super efficient. And basically, for the cost of a cab ride, a little bit more. Now they've got Uber X, which is actually the cost of a cab ride a little bit less. Again, no tips. They will take you anywhere you want to go. And they do it in nice, clean, brand new, freshly, you know, spiffy cars and nice drivers. And it's really pretty cool. But it's still a meritocracy, because when you get out, before you can order the next car on the app, you are required to rate that driver 1 to 5 stars. And if their number of stars starts dropping below a certain threshold, I'm not sure what it is. I've heard that it's 4.5, but or four. I don't know. Nobody at Uber's ever explicitly told me. I've had drivers tell me, but if they fall below that number, they lose their job. They lose their gig with Uber. And on the other hand, when you get out of the car, they rate you. So, you know, if you show up at 2 o'clock in the morning, drunk out of your mind and pee all over the back seat of their car, and that, by the way, this is the kind of stuff that happens relatively commonly in taxis. People throw up in them, you know, et cetera. They rate you 1 star and you get rated badly a couple of times and they just won't take your business anymore. The company. So there is something to be said for some sort of a meritocratic system in the service industry. But this whole let's pay restaurant workers lousy wages, you know, the minimum wage is suspended for restaurant workers in most places. Or Portland, Oregon, where I used to live just recently, I mean, just in the last couple of years when I was living there, said, okay, we're going to do away with this. You have to pay restaurant workers minimum wage, which is $8 and something in Portland. And you can tip them. And all the restaurants were like, this is going to be the end of the world, but it wasn't. So this is not just, you know, kind of small talk stuff. This has to do with the one of the largest and one of the only growing industries in the United States.
Are you your work? Come on, honestly. Most of us human beings define ourselves more by our human doings. It's a blurring brought to us courtesy of the American work ethic, and one that, in addition to plain old need, drives Americans to work longer hours and longer years than any of our industrial world colleagues. While unemployment is high and productivity is through the roof, can we really raise no other demand for change than the one for ever more work? Oscar Wilde once said that a map of the world that does not include utopia is not worth even glancing at. So we've invited someone in to help us fill out that map. Kathy Weeks is an associate professor and director of graduate studies at Duke University and the author of the book, The Problem with Work, Feminism, Marxism, Anti-Work Politics, and Post-Work Imaginaries. Kathy, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
So first off on the data, how does the U.S. compare to the rest of the what used to be called the developed world? I sometimes wonder if we are that developed after all.
We work longer and harder than other countries. And even, you know, I mean, our productivity, as you said, is through the roof, and that's true. But even, I think some of the recent measures is that we're not the most productive workers per hour. And some people even suggest it's because we work too much. And we become sort of less productive on an hourly basis because of this, you know, overwork.
And vacation days?
Oh, we're so bad on vacation days.
We're talking in the height of the summer in New York. It's supposed to be vacation season. But most of us are working through. What's wrong with that?
It says at least two things for me. I mean, one of them is that we are under the thumbs of our employers. I mean, if we don't have the power to even demand some basic vacation time or to take it if we're offered. That says something about the condition, the relationship of power between employers and employees, generally speaking. But, you know, at another level, it might say something about our lack of imagination, you know, about what we would do. I mean, I think some people really do live for their work. And I don't think that's healthy. I don't think that's healthy economically. Right? We don't have enough work to go around, for one thing. And I don't think it's healthy individually or socially. I think there's other kinds of activities, collective practices that we should be engaged in besides either work or collapse. But also, you know, to think more generally about work in the way that I want to think about it, I think that includes thinking about the work ethic, you know, the ideology of work, right? A work ethic that teaches us that work is, you know, a highest calling, a moral duty, an ethical practice, an end in itself. I mean, I think that this ideology of work has really helped encourage us to invest more in work than we might otherwise. So part of this critique of work is really aimed at a critique of the work ethic.
Mm-hmm. Which is internalized as well as imposed on it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, most social systems work through both coercion and consent, right? I mean, and so one of the reasons why we work so long and hard is like, simple. It's because we have to, right? It's the only way you can earn income, and most of us don't have the power to negotiate very much with our employers. But I think that's just part of the story. I mean, because I think also consent is manufactured to this state of affairs. You know, what makes us willing to live for work instead of just work to live? You know, what makes us willing to be obedient to these outrageous demands on the part of employers who won't even give us vacation
days? So what does make us that way?
Well, I mean, that's what I'm trying to puzzle through. And that's why I really wanted to focus on this history and of the ideology of work, and how we internalize it and to what, you know, and at what psychological and social costs.
All right. So talk a little bit about the history. I was interested to read in your writings, a reference to a man I'd never heard of, Hugo Black, an Alabama Democrat who in the 1930s proposed a 30-hour work week and got a huge majority in the Senate to approve. Was he an outlier?
Those were, you know, dire times in some ways. But I think that there's been a long history, you know, until that point, really until about World War II, where labor unions focused on less work. I mean, that was on the agenda, right? Shorting hours from 14 to 12 to 10, right, to 8. I mean, this was a huge part of the labor movement and a really important focus. And then it sort of fell off the map. What and happened? We really haven't had any reductions in work hours since around World War II.
So what happened?
I think there's a lot of answers to that question. I mean, one of them is unions started to focus more on wage demands. And I think certain kind of constituencies for shorter hours got, you know, sort of quieted in certain kinds of workplaces. But I think it's a much more complicated history than that. And again, I would always want to go back to sort of larger kinds of cultural processes and the way that work became so elevated in our imagination and other possibilities get closed off.
How is it specifically for women with respect to all of this? Because your work looks a lot at the relation of feminism to this. And out of the feminist movement have come some discussions of this very topic, wages for housework, things like that.
Yeah. I mean, I think feminists, too, have focused more on other kinds of agendas around work. So, you know, primarily they've focused on trying to gain women access to all kinds of professions, all kinds of jobs, and to help them, you know, work their way up the, you know, the hierarchy within those professions. And then second, I think feminists have focused on trying to gain recognition for, support for, sharing of unwaged domestic household-based labor. And I think those are both really important struggles. The second one is a little closer to my heart. But the problem with both of them is that they end up sort of reproducing a kind of classic work ethic discourse, right? Because they're trying to sing the praises of either waged work for women or the importance and the dignity of unwaged work that we should all be doing. And they end up sort of essentially bolstering, right, and reproducing and empowering that kind of work ethic discourse. The other thing they do is, unwittingly often, I think that they help enable the language and sentiments of family values discourses because the two options we're left with those agendas are work and family.
Now, it's interesting to go back to the days of May Day and the organizing for the 8-hour day that you refer to, where the demands were not 8 hours for work and 8 hours for rest and 8 hours for family. They were different.
Yeah. And 8 hours for what we will, right, which is such a wonderful formulation. Because it opens it up, right?
So there's where 8 for work, 8 for rest, and 8 for what we will.
Yeah.
So we've lost that.
Yes.
How do we bring it back? Do you see anybody out there bringing it back?
I do. I'm really encouraged. I think, I mean, in some ways, the crisis has made it more clear to more people that work isn't working, right? I mean, the unemployment level alone suggests that it's just not working as a mechanism of income distribution and social inclusion, right? Too many people are left out, too many people are excluded. So I think more people than ever are aware that this just isn't working on a systematic level. It's not just a problem with this job or that job. This is a problem with a system that expects us to rely on waged work in order to live.
And what other systems could we have?
I mean, I'm really interested in other kinds of demands, demands for shorter working hours where people would have more time for what they will, right? And that might include also unwaged domestic work, but also demands for a guaranteed basic income, you know, some kind of basic income that would be guaranteed for all individuals so that they wouldn't fall through this structurally unstable floor that we're all sitting on. Now, I think most people would still want to engage in some kind of productive activity, and I think people would want more than the minimum. So I think most people would be willing to engage in work, but I think it would give workers a stronger bargaining position to demand better kind of work. It would allow some people to opt out if they wanted and they had other things that they could do. And it would help a system that doesn't produce enough work for all of us, right? So I think it's a more rational way to organize an economy in some ways.
Before everybody says it's so radical, it's something that the Nixon administration considered.
Right.
Where are you watching today, or what are you thinking about as you watch today's protests by fast food workers, retail workers, most of them resisting a move to more part-time work, resisting a move to more sort of entrepreneurial status where they're all contractors for somebody they don't even know. Very different from what you're talking about.
Well, and I think for good reason they aren't making, you know, those other kinds of options. And I don't want part-time work if it means a, you know, a decrease in pay and a loss of benefits, which is what it means now. And shorter hours would be different from that. It's not just moving everyone to part-time. It's actually reducing the legal working day in some ways and the level at which you would have to pay overtime. But, I mean, I think, you know, look, in a system where it depends on work, we have to demand more work. And I think that's a very important politics. But I would also want to always include in there a demand for less work, too. And in some ways, I read what they're demanding is less work, too, so that they don't have to have two jobs. Right? Part of this is getting a living wage, which I think of as a wage that can support a life outside work.
All right, so here we are in the summer of 2013 with the economic conditions that we've talked about, wage stagnation, unemployment still high, productivity, well, national productivity doing fine, and continuing a discourse about austerity, continuing a discussion about cuts, cuts, cuts. Live for a moment in your utopian world. What would you see? What would you prefer to see us be talking about in this moment?
Oh, I mean, spreading wealth. I mean, we have incredible wealth. I mean, I think that language of austerity should always be refused. I mean, it's a ruse, right? So I think that part of what I'm interested in, too, with these sort of utopian demands of less work and a guaranteed basic income is the way that they help us sort of think more critically about the relationship between work and the rest of life, but also more imaginatively about the possibilities of a life that's not so relentlessly subordinated to work. What would I do if I had more non-work time? What would my relationship to my work be if the economic necessity to work was alleviated just a bit? You know, if the link between work and income was sort of loosened a bit. And I think it opens up all these possibilities for thinking about living differently. I mean, who has time to do anything between work and family? So I also want to sort of open up the possibilities for, again, what we will, you know, what would we do? And does it make us anxious? If so, why? That in itself is interesting. So I really think that these demands are really generative, not just of needed reforms that would help people live their lives, but also generative of critical perspectives and of the political imagination. And we have so few opportunities to exercise our political imagination. So I also want the demands to do that for us, and the practice of demanding to enable us collectively to do some of that thinking and imagining.
Kathy Weeks is the author of The Problem with Work.
Today's activism segment comes to you, as always, in partnership with the Unfuck It Up Project, where creator Katie Goodman and activist director Katie Klobusik highlight individuals and organizations working to change the world. Today's campaign, Small Business Saturday. It's unusual for me to promote a campaign started by a giant corporation, but good ideas sometimes come from unusual places. Small Business Saturday may have been created by American Express, but the idea has spread to communities across the country as a way to promote local spending around the holidays. November 27th, 2010 was the first official Small Business Saturday, scheduled right after Black Friday to oppose the Walmart-promoted rush to trample your neighbors style consumerism the holidays have become known for. It was officially recognized by the Senate in 2011 and now has both a national
national Facebook page and some local ones cropping up around the country. Shopping small, it turns out, doesn't just have a negative effect on the anti-labor, anti-environment big box stores we loathe. It has a positive effect on our communities. According to the American Independent Business Alliance, for every dollar spent at a small business, 68% stays local, giving a boost to the economy. For every dollar spent at a chain, that same amount is immediately sent overseas or to CEOs whose bottom lines don't need your help, especially this time of year. Even if you're anti-consumerism, anti-capitalism, or relatively income-challenged, you're likely to do some gift-giving this season. And if that's the case and you do have to shop, do what you can to fuel your local economy while you're at it. Many communities turn Small Business Saturday into an event with special deals, outreach, family activities, etc. Take the opportunity to meet the merchants in your city and see what routine purchases you make that might be met by local shops. Simply being out this Saturday, November 30th, instead of on Black Friday, is a visible statement that your town or city matters to you. So check out smallbusinesssaturday.com for more information and Google your own area to find planned celebrations you can participate in this weekend. And now a quick thought about how this type of activism isn't about doing what's right and in line with your values 100% of the time. It's about doing the best you can as often as you can. As I've been saying for years, that which you can't find locally in independently owned businesses, you're most likely going to buy online. And if there's anything you need that you can't find on Small Business Saturday, keep in mind that Cyber Monday, which follows just 2 days later, can act as a sort of backup. And I've been holding my nose in advertising for Amazon for years now, suggesting them as just such a backup, because at the very least, you can shop through the affiliate link posted at bestoftheleft.com, which will siphon off some of the corporate profits and redirect them to this progressive media outlet, all while not changing how you shop or the price of anything you were planning on buying anyways. Thanks for doing the best you can as often as you can. You probably didn't fuck it up, but they, whoever they are, they fucked it up. Now it's fucked up. Could you help unfuck it up? And say, are you really so fucking busy you can't take one fucking minute to help unfuck it up? Because I'm willing to pick one thing to help unfuck it up. Won't you join me?
I want to talk a little bit about Costco and Trader Joe's. Now, for a long time, we've talked on this program about how claims from Walmart that they simply cannot afford to raise wages and pay a true living wage to employees without being without losing profitability doesn't really make sense, because we can look at Costco, which pays a living wage and has much lower employee turnover and is very, very profitable. It clearly is possible. And a lot of people write to me and they say, hold on a second, David, you're not taking a very important piece of information into consideration. And that is that Costco has a membership fee, so that when we look at the profit margin on Walmart products versus Costco products, you have to take into consideration that Costco is padding their balance sheet, so to speak, by having this membership fee. Of course, that is not actually a good argument, but let's assume it is for a second. We now have a very good article in The Atlantic talking about Trader Joe's. Trader Joe's also paying employees a living wage and also profiting significantly. And the approach to a lot of people just seems like common sense. You keep the shelves stocked. You have employees who are paid well, which makes them provide better customer service. It reduces turnover, so your costs for having to replace employees are lower, and you are still profitable. So, Lewis, I think at this point, this argument about Costco that it's an exception, they can do something Walmart can't because of those membership fees, does the Trader Joe's example not provide even more data that Walmart could raise wages and still be profitable? I mean, for lack of a better term, they would still be very profitable.
Oh, yeah, of course. And it's not just Trader Joe's. You have any number of companies. Starbucks is another one of these companies. There are many, and many small businesses, too. The thing is that if it's true what the execs are saying about Walmart not being able to be profitable by paying their employees a minimum, a livable wage, then that means that they are doing something very wrong from a sales and business point of view.
Right. It would bring into question many other aspects of Walmart's business. And the reality is we can make a lot of criticisms about Walmart, but they know how to do business. They know how to get good prices for the products that they're selling. They know how to fill the supply chain so you don't have stock issues. I mean, Walmart are good business people, and it is simply not believable that they really believe if they raised wages, they would all of a sudden lose profitability. Just doesn't make any sense. I just flat out don't believe it. I guess most people don't have time to uprise. They're too busy working two jobs to survive. And they don't work as for support, and they work us to make that profit. Someday we gotta stop it. Every song I've written is about more than music. We don't have to be living in this system. I can prove it. You heard of people's movement in the people's music revolution. Can't expect the current system to make solutions. Legalize drugs, set up help for the addicts. How can you imprison a person for falling into bad habits? Instead of contracts for weapons, use that money for free transit. Free public transportation, the environment, insulation. We could use that money in the cities to make them decent. Give homeless people homes, skyscrapers are not needed. Use money that's building prisons on paying the teachers more. Stop working for profit, start working to ensure our people's needs are met. Then we wouldn't have the poor.
What we haven't been talking about is this new model of capitalism, which has taken hold of America as a consequence of Reaganomics. Now, the two things apropos of that. The first is Ted Cruz. Somebody asked him, well, what did you get out of this budget, you know, shutting down the government? And he said, we saw, first of all, millions of American people rising up across this country, over 2 million people signing a national petition to defund Obamacare. In other words, he harvested 2 million email addresses. He also took in $797,000 in contributions, Ted Cruz, as a result of this shutting down the government. And the Heritage Action Fund, the Heritage Foundation's PAC, they took in $330,000 so far. And with that 2 million email addresses, they'll be able to go back every month and say, hey, how about another 10 bucks? $10 and 2 million people? If all of them gave 10 bucks, and some will give 20 and some will give nothing, so let's say that they all gave on average $10, because some will give 200 and some will, you know, and maybe a 10 will give nothing. $10 a person, 2 million addresses, that's 20 million bucks a month that Ted Cruz could be bringing in as a result of having shut down our government. So he shuts down the government, and meanwhile, 2,033 civilian employees were laid off. These are people who, like, you know, man the food shops around the national parks, or people whose business depends on tourism around the Statue of Liberty, that kind of thing. 883,392 actual government employees got laid off. $206 million worth of supplemental food assistance to women, infant, and children in severe need. These are the desperately poor and high-risk children. $206 million worth of food was not given to them over the last 2.5 weeks. $2,982,000,000 in unpaid salaries. So that's what happened. But this new model of capitalism, the thing I really, really wanted to riff on, this was invented in large part, I would submit to you, by Walmart and the companies that were following the Walmart model. Now, I don't know if Walmart invented it, but they certainly have perfected it. And we used to think this was just a Walmart problem. And here's how the business model works. We will do business in a way that will make a profit for us, but it will also generate some costs. But the public will pay for those costs. So tax dollars will pay for the costs that are created by our doing business the way that we do. And we get to keep all the profits. Now, to the best of my knowledge, there is not a good name for this kind of capitalism, which is a real shame, because this is the new American capital model. Now, it's been going on for a long, long time. You know, you've heard me a million times say, you know, the mission of business is it internalize profits, externalize costs. keep the profits in the company, put the costs on the people. And you could go all the way back to John Rockefeller's oil wells in Ohio in the 1880s. Standard Oil in New Jersey in the 1890s. I mean, to this day, the Koch brothers are refining oil in Michigan and Chicago and refining the tar sands crude and ending up with these huge piles of waste that when the wind blows, just go downwind into largely poor African-American communities and pollute the air. They keep the profit. We get the trash. But the way that Walmart did it was Walmart keeps the profit and they pay their employees so little that their employees are literally impoverished. They literally are living below or at or near to the poverty line. And as a consequence, their employees are eligible for food stamps and housing assistance and heating assistance in the winter and Medicare or Medicaid rather. And so we are subsidizing their employees. They pay their employees $7, $8, $9 an hour. It's not enough to live on. You really need, you know, $10, $11, $12 an hour to live on. I mean, $12 an hour is what the minimum wage was in 1968. And back in 68, most of the people working in for the minimum wage were young people just entering the job market. So to make up that difference between the $9 an hour that they're paid and the $12 or $13 or $14 or $15 an hour that it actually costs to live, people are getting benefits from the government. Which means you and I are subsidizing the workers at Walmart. And we've seen where, you know, one study was done that showed that just one Walmart store basically sucked up about $1 million a year in benefits for its employees. So every Walmart store is costing us, the taxpayers, say $1 million a year. Well, here comes this new study. This is just amazing. This is from the University of California, Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education. Ken Jacobs is the spokes guy for this. And he says that the wages of America's fast food chains are so low. Now, this is just the fast food industry. I'm not talking about Walmart anymore. This is what I'm pointing out is that this is spreading, this form of the vampire capitalism. Right. And they have their fangs into the bloodstream of we the people, into our tax dollars. America's fast food chains are paying so little to their employees that their employees used, and now they looked at the years 2007 through 2011. So this is a 4-year study. Good solid study. $7 billion a year that you and I are paying in taxes that gets shifted to the workers of these fast food restaurants. They said the 10 chains, this is the National Employment Law Project found, the 10 chains with two and a quarter million workers, this is about a 60% of the no benefit business model, they call this. Just these 10 chains, this is McDonald's, Yum Brands, which is Pizza Hut, Taco Bell, KFC, Subway, Burger King, Wendy's, Dunkin' Donuts, Dairy Queen, Little Caesars, Sonic, and Domino's. Okay, just those 10 companies have 2.5 million workers. Their workers took $3.8 billion in benefits, public benefits. We subsidized those companies, those 10 companies, to the tune of $3.8 billion. The executives at those companies made more than $53 million in compensation, and $7.7 billion was paid in dividends and buybacks to their shareholders. So they show a $7.5 billion profit, and we kick in $3.8 billion so that their employees can stay alive and come to work every day. This doesn't even count the other, you know, I've always talked about, you know, the cost of providing a workforce where people can actually spell and read and write and add and run an addy machine and, you know, public roads that they can drive to work on and all of these things that these corporations should be paying for that they're by and large typically not, because they figure out these tax dodge schemes, these tax avoidance schemes, or they come into town and they say, oh yeah, we'll create jobs here, but give us, you know, 10 years no taxes, or give us some free land or something like that. We'll be right back. Do you have an idea for a name for this kind of capitalism? I'm trying to name it, and I need a name.
Walmart in Cleveland, Ohio. Walmart is setting up bins of alternating colors of purple and orange. It's a food drive. Good for Walmart for supporting the community. Oh, no, it's not for the community. It's a food drive for its own needy workers. This is just stunning. Corey Lundberg, a Walmart spokesman, said the food drive is proof that employees care about each other.
If only their employer did as well.
It's for associates who have had some hardships come up. Maybe their spouse lost a job, or maybe both spouses work here. No, I added that last bite.
I did a double take.
This is part of the company's culture.
I didn't even blink. I thought that was an accurate quote. I really did.
This is part of the company's culture to rally around associates and take care of them when they face extreme hardships. I have another way that the company's culture could rally around associates. Pay them a living wage. The Associates in Critical Need Trust is funded by Walmart employee contributions that can be given through a payroll deduction. Employees can receive grants up to $1,500 to address hardships they may encounter. This is not part of that. That's another separate Walmart-wide program. Vanessa Ferrer of our Walmart organizer says she flipped out when she first saw the photos taken by the Canton worker. Why would a company do that? The company needs to stand up and give them 40 hours and a living wage. So they don't have to worry about whether they can afford Thanksgiving. Unbelievable.
This holiday season, holiday season, help a Walmart worker. Donate your jacket, donate your clothes, your food. It's unbelievable.
I was thinking that reminded me of, do you remember that moment? It's one of the most awkward moments I feel like in modern politics when Bush was out pushing Social Security privatization.
Uniquely American.
Yes, exactly. And this woman's talking this horror story of like working three different jobs. And even if you could tell with Bush, there's a moment where somewhere in his mind, he's like, wow, that sounds like kind of messed up. And then he just like looks at her. He's like, what are you saying?
Well, she had said, like, I work two or three jobs to do this. And he just looks at her and he goes, good for you for working two or three jobs. That is uniquely American. That's just how stunning, like the
she
pride.
She had kids. It was for insurance.
The pride he takes in the fact that this woman has to work multiple jobs to support her family. Only in America do you have to do that. I think we should be proud. I, for one, barely worked one job for most of my life. I'm less than American.
Well, I see.
Or I'm also uniquely American insofar as I had a family that just sort of took me through life. I skated through until I wound up in the presidency. I didn't realize that would be so hard. It's hard work. Governor of Texas, you just cut a couple of ribbons. It's not like punching that clock. That's why I had to always leave work at home. I mean, take a bunch of vacations.
Although literally punching clocks can be fun.
Yeah.
But someone will say, like, this shows you the spirit of charity in business.
Yeah.
You'll hear that spin.
Oh, definitely.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.